I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History at Time. I'm recording this from the History Hit Bunker. News just in that whilst a Russian fleet is on manoeuvres off the east coast of England, the heir to the throne and the First Lord of the Treasury, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, have both got this pandemic disease. That's a sentence I never thought I'd be speaking, even just a few weeks ago. But there we are. On the podcast this episode, we've got Omid Jalili. He's a wonderful actor, he's a comedian, and he's a writer too. And I'm going to talk to him about his new show, in which he plays about a million different characters himself. And it's all about 19th century Persia, based on a true story. I talked to him about his fascination with history. So many creative people, so many poets, directors, comedians that we've had on the podcast just are obsessed with history. It's great to see their fellow travellers, and Omid is definitely one of them. Lovely, lovely man. Got to reminisce a little bit about him playing the part of the slave trader in Gladiator. Little did I imagine when I watched Gladiator for the first time as a first-year undergrad student in an empty cinema in Oxford, that one day I'd be chatting away to one of the actors in there about the experience. So it's, as ever, such an honour to be on this podcast and talk to these wonderful people. It's also an honour to be involved in History Hit TV. It's been strange times because in these times of isolation, these times of homeschooling, we've had a huge number of people signing up to History Hit TV. Thank you very much for that. It's all come as a bit of a shock. We're slightly overwhelmed, actually, but we're going to do our best to make sure that we do try and meet the demand for teaching aids, supporting teachers and parents so they try and keep their kids enthused and learning through these really difficult times. We're sort of gearing up. We're gearing up. You can get History Hit TV for free for a month and then another month for just £1, euro or dollar. So it's basically just £1 just for the first 2 months, which should hopefully see us through this crisis. If you use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, when you check out. So please go and do that. There are hundreds of history documentaries on there. We've lined them up by educational tier. So you should be able to see if you want to get it for your kids, you'll be able to hopefully see relevant content for the ages and the stages that they're at and the topics as well. So thank you very much. Lastly, I'm very excited that I've got my big collaboration with the world's biggest history YouTube channel, Timeline. They're a fantastic YouTube channel. They have lots of documentaries on there for free. And we are now doing regular slots on there talking to some of the world's best historians, basically doing History Hit Lives on there. So please go to Timeline on YouTube and check out the History Hit Lives as well. In the meantime, everyone, at the end of this week of isolation, I hope we're not all going too crazy at home. I hope things are going well. I hope that the vast majority of people listening to this will avoid getting sick. We've had a couple of people on the team get sick. Thankfully, they're looking like they've all recovered really well. And because we stood the team down and isolated them all quite a long time ago, we've played our small part. History Hit's played its small part in making sure that the disease hasn't spread. For those few of you who are in the middle of it, I hope you get well, and I hope you find that listening to History Hit enables you to get to sleep quicker. I'm sure it does. Enjoy Omid, everyone. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is Omid. It's an honour to have comedy royalty here.
An honour to be
I think you're actually royalty, I think you're my first gladiator veteran as well, which is
yes
exciting.
Yeah, gladiator, when I famously had my nether regions oh, yes. grabbed by Oliver Reed.
He grabbed your balls.
He grabbed my balls, yes, and he said to me, are you a method actor? I don't know if I've told you that there's a story behind that where he said to me, "Oh, you method actor," and I said, "Yeah," because in the original script, he's supposed to punch me.
Okay.
And we had a little conflab. Ridley Scott always had this cigar. He goes, "We're going to cut the punch. We want him to grab you. Are you all right with that?" And I said, "Whatever you want, Mr. Scott, whatever."
Yeah, sure. I'm just glad to be here, buddy.
And Oliver Reed said, we'll deal with it. And he goes, "Are you method actor?" And I said, I didn't know what it meant. I'm like, yeah. He goes, "Do you mind if I really grab you?" I said, "Just grab me." He goes, "No, but can I go under the tunic?" And I said, "What do you mean go under the tunic?" He goes, "Just lift up and I'll go under the tunic, make it more realistic." And I said, "How would that work? Why would you do that?" He goes, "No, the camera won't see it. We'll do a close-up afterwards. But if you allow me to just come up to me, lift up your tunic, I go under, I grab you, and then we'll do the scene up here."
Gay giraffes.
Yeah, it was all that gay giraffe stuff. And then and I did the rehearsal. And I said, "Is this working?" And then Ridley Scott was saying, "I didn't know there's all a trick they're playing on me." And he grabbed me, and then we're ready for a take. He goes, "You're right, lift it up." So I come up, I said, "Proxima, my old friend, lift up my tunic." His hand would go in, and he'd hold me. And we do the scene, and they shouted cut after the first thing. And then usually you'd have a cup of tea, but he carried on holding me in between the takes. And just,
oh my
so God. I held, and I just asked him, just try to be natural. I said, "You enjoying the hotel?" "This is fine." And then by take three or four, he started moving me around. And I just thought, is this a wind-up? And it was. But, you know, in those days, Tony, this is like, I could have, like, taken them to court to for some kind of abuse, but I just thought this was all kind of like male bonding.
Lads
kind of
on tour.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because they all knew I was a bit scared of him as well. I kind of stayed in my room away from when they were all like drinking at night. I stayed in my room quietly because he was a real rabble rouser, Oliver. Yeah. I was a bit scared of him. But anyway, sorry.
But
Gladiator,
you,
yes.
You like lots of comedians. History's a valuable, history's a big reservoir for you guys.
History is huge for us. Yeah, we take history very, very seriously. The accuracy of history, and we talk about a lot of stand-up routines are about what's real, what's not. So yeah,
isn't that because you know I was watching one about the sort of returning stolen goods to people that are in the British Museum the other day, the one you're touring at the moment is about I never know how to pronounce that, millenarianism.
Millennial expectation for the return of Christ around between 1843 and 1845. All kinds of madness was going on.
How did you land on that particular?
Well, I'm a Baha'i, and the Baha'i faith started around this particular period of time. But I was very interested from a historical point of view that this was something that a lot of people were expecting. There was the Millerites. Who were now the Seventh-day Adventists. And it wasn't just that, it was Christians. I even read that there were kind of Buddhists and Chinese people were like, that the Messiah will come in the West. So they were going from like East to West and all seemed to be congregating in Persia at that time. Whilst at the same time, people were expecting Christ to come on a cloud in the West. That the people would, you know, like the Monty Python sketch, it goes, "Well, same again tomorrow," and all that kind of stuff. So I just was fascinated that actually there was this global fever for this expectation for some kind of momentous thing to happen. And what the play is saying that something did actually happen, and it's up to people to decide what it was, because it was so tumultuous. 20,000 people killed, there's a lot of executions and craziness, and there were prophet figures, and there were people dying for a noble cause. So I wanted to really look into it and see if there's a great one-man show that we can do about it, because it's not even a forgotten period of history, because this is all recorded in British history. It's all recorded in the Times newspaper. People were going out, that people like Professor Edward Granville Brown, a lot of the early suffragettes were hearing these stories, well, people who became suffragettes, that there was this faith talking about the equality of men and women and all that, and they got very inspired. So there was this tremendous, I suppose, movement and excitement and inspiration, and people going backwards and forwards to the Middle East and coming back and talking about it. And it was just a very exciting period. So the play captures what was going on then.
Well, it doesn't seem like the most obvious topic. I mean, was it about it just that attracted you? Is there a modern resonance with whether it's climate or people getting nervous about things like what, or Trumpism?
I think that the this is a play I did many years ago. It was at the
Edinburgh Festival. It won the big award.
It won lots of awards and things. And you know what? You forget about it because I always look back at my days as a kind of young actor, as someone who just wanted to...
Well, you're still a young actor.
I'm still a young actor, but I just wanted to do fresh, original stuff. And it was a story that I was raised with, and no one had actually put it into a dramatic, any kind of dramatic context. And when we put it together, it was so well received by people who don't know anything about the Baha'i Faith. They don't know anything about this period. And we had a lot of scholars come along and say, yes, that's absolutely right. And then when we did it again in the British Library in 2019, just last year, and there was a bloke who saw it in 1993 and said, would you do it again? And I said, what's it for? He goes, this is for the bicentenary of the birth of one of these prophet figures. And I said, what do you remember about it? What do you remember? And he said, not much, Matt, to be honest, because I was off my head. I was on drink and drugs at the Edinburgh Festival. But he goes, I do remember that you played this executioner, and this executioner was killing people and talking about it. And I just thought, you know, it's time the executioners had their say, because no one asked an executioner. And I thought that was very interesting. And then he said, I just remember when the executioner then meets the prophet figure and they have this moment. And there are no words between them, but then the executioner expresses it in a wicked bongo solo. I just want to see that again. So we did it again, and all these Oxford dons and all these kind of historical people came along and said, yes, what you don't know is this, and yes, that was absolutely accurate. And then somebody came along who was the great-great-great-grandson of one of the executioners that we're talking about, and he showed us a photograph. And it was a photograph that really affected me, because they're saying this particular executioner who was killing all these Barbies and Baha'is, these two groups of people who had espoused this new faith, he was killing them all. And then an event, they've caught the photograph 10 seconds before an event that changed his life. And they emailed it to me, and I couldn't believe it, because in those days they used to kill these Barbies by these new people who professed a new faith. They used to put them in front of a cannon and blow them to pieces. So there's a photograph of a guy.
And this is in Persia.
This is in Persia, yeah. It's in Persia. This photograph is from 1849. We actually put the photograph in the show now, and there's a credits section. And it's moments before they blow this guy up, and the executioner stood behind, as normal. You stand behind the cannon, blow this guy to pieces, and then you pick up the pieces and bring the next one. But apparently a bit of flesh flew back somehow and hit him on the shoulder, and totally affected him. I know this all sounds a bit gory, but he then became, he espoused this faith. We understand that he then was executed himself. But all his generations espoused this particular faith, and they totally supported this play and totally said, you're absolutely right. And it was other scholars and people seem to know about this particular character. So since then, I've had a lot of historical validation. Because, you know, you do a piece and you think, should we just play around with this bit of history? And then every time we've played around with it a little bit, we've actually been proved right, you know. So in the play, we also have a kind of tea party in the 1890s in the home counties where people used to talk about this. And there's a character who was called Millicent, who, and then her auntie's trying to marry her off to somebody. And then we said, she's first heard about equality of men and women, maybe we should make her Millicent Fawcett, who was a famous suffragette. And then people from Cambridge came along and said, absolutely right. Yes, Millicent Fawcett first heard about this from people who came over talking about this crazy thing that was going on and this faith that was espousing equality of men. So you're absolutely right. That's where she first heard it. In fact, she was supposed to go. She was supposed to go and meet the son of the prophet figure, but just never went. So any turn that we've done where we've tried to make it a little bit kind of, are we playing around with history, has turned out to be correct.
You're like Hilary Mantel. I mean, historians are queuing up saying she's probably right. We're probably wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
She's exactly. Probably right about Cromwell.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. brought to you by History Hit.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
But does it matter? I often ask that the actors and the directors I get on here, like, does it matter to you that you are getting that validation from the history side?
It does, very much. Okay. Because I want it to be accurate, and I want it to be... If I, you know, even a film like Gladiator, you know, when you look back, I'm sure a lot of that is... I mean, you know it's a film when there are helicopter shots of Rome. You can see everything. So, you know, they're playing around with creativity. You never get a shot like that. But a lot of that, I remember working on that, and I remember asking Ridley Scott, so was Commodus killed? And he was saying, well, some of it is fictitious. We're playing around with it. But we want to, it's very clear that we don't want to get nonsense from historians. So as long as we keep the basis of it based in truth, then we're okay. Because actually the things that really happen is what are the lessons for us in future generations about what really happened.
And is it particularly true because you're making a show that's about your, it's about your identity as well.
Yes, it is. Because, you know, I was raised in Britain. I'm a second generation Iranian, fifth generation Baha'i. So my forefathers were kind of traveling troubadours. They would travel around. They were poets. That's why we have poets in the show as well, who are based in modern times. It's me kind of saying this is me five generations back. My family were traveling troubadours where they go around and do their poetry, set up a tent. And people would give them arms and money, and that was it. There's like passing a hat around. And then they became Baha'is, and then they went around after their poetry. They said, look, we're going to have a meeting if anyone wants to hear more about this, and then they get chased out. A lot of people become Baha'is. A lot of people would try and kill them. So poetry was something that I really wanted to have in the show as part of my heritage. But also as a second-generation Iranian, I always struggled being raised in the 1970s as, you know, an Iranian looking kid. And I did a lot to kind of make myself look more Iranian. I was 14, I had a moustache. I was already fully developed. I had man boobs when I was like 15. And I just looked very dark. And there weren't that many Iranian kids around. And also, it would have been okay if they thought I was a Muslim, but I wasn't a Muslim. I was part of this, the Baha'i faith. It was... What's that? So there was always confusion around me, and I've always said I'm a minority within a minority, within a minority, within a minority, because I'm a British, I'm not British, I'm Iranian, and even amongst the Iranians, I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Baha'i, so I'm a minority. And even within the Baha'i community, people thought my family were weird, and then even within my family, I thought they were all weird. So I'm kind of, the kind of levels of cosmic kind of isolation are quite deep with me, but that's why I'm doing this. One particular play is me, I suppose, struggling to reclaim my identity and really say, actually, also from a historical point of view, this is a period of history which I don't think we've paid enough attention to. And the people who did pay attention to it are kind of ignoring it now. I mean, there was an amazing thing that happened where this prophet figure was executed. And it was covered in the Times newspaper that it was seen as some kind of crazy miracle, where in those days they didn't just kill you, they had to bring out like a regiment of 500 people, and they were with bayonets, they'd shoot, and then there'd be massive smoke, you have to wait for the smoke to clear, then you go and pick up the bodies, and they've usually enmeshed into each other, been hit by so many bullets. And this particular prophet figure, the Barb was his name, and he was going to be killed with someone with him. And when they shot, and before it happened, the leader of the regiment, who was a guy called Sam Khan, who was a Christian, went up to him and said, look, this is our job. We really don't want to do this. Is there anything you can do? And he said to him, if your intention is sincere, it'll all be taken care of. I went, okay. And they shot. And when the smoke cleared, the Barb and they disappeared. There was pandemonium. They couldn't find him. They found him back in his cell, finishing off a conversation with his secretary. He said, I wasn't finished yet. Wasn't time for me to die yet. like the prophets of God, they choose when to die. Like when Jesus is on the cross, it's not like as if they've killed Jesus. When Jesus chooses, like, you can kill me now. He wasn't ready then. So then that group, that regiment left, said, well, that's our sign, we're gone. They brought in another regiment of 750 people. Now, we don't know what the exact miracle was. In those days, they used to hold them up by ropes. And apparently the gunshots severed the ropes. So it could be that 500 people didn't want to do it and they just lifted up. That could be the miracle. But still, that is
miraculous.
Kind of miraculous, yeah, that they did that. And this was covered in the Times newspaper. There were people. This story, by the way, that we talk about in the show was in the newspapers all the time around 1850s. In fact, I did the show in Ireland and a historian said, if you look at the Roscommon Times, people used to sit down for breakfast and say, now what's going on in Persia now in the 1850s? What's happened to the Bab? Has he been killed yet? So it was serialized and people were talking about it. But it's interesting, no film's been made about it, no one. So I'm hoping to start interest with this and get maybe proper filmmakers and proper historians to really go away and put together and make a film about it, because it could be a big Hollywood blockbuster, you never know.
Fingers crossed. And I guess the problem is it's an orphan story because Iran, in the theocracy, they're not interested in this apostasy.
Absolutely not.
Right.
I had Iranians see the show and they were laughing. I said, why are you laughing?
They said,
in a good way, because this is our heritage. But if you even put the show on, they wouldn't let you perform it. 5 minutes in, they'd arrest you, they'd put you in prison, because this is not the story that we tell in history classes. And if we do, it's very distorted. There was a mad group of people. And they were suppressed, they were all killed off. So that's how Iranian people are growing up. I went to university. When I was at university, I played for a football team called the Persian Empire. I played for the university football team, but there was a five-a-side league, and I joined up with the other Iranians, and we got to the final. And you know, there's university, there's about 100 teams. So to get to the final, you've got to get through 16 rounds. And we got to the final, and before the final, I got dropped because they found out I was a Baha'i. They said, you're a Baha'i? I said, yeah. And they were like, what the hell? We know about you people. And I said, first of all, what's you people? We're all Iranians. They said, and I remember them being really upset. And then before the final, they dropped me from the team because I'd joined their team. They were third years and I was a fresher. And they made a decision to drop me from the team. And then they lost in the final, and I'd kind of got them to the final. I was the one scoring all the goals and everything. So I was really shocked and surprised. And then one of them said, I really need to ask you questions about this because you look like a normal bloke. I said, I am a normal bloke. He goes, but the things we've been taught about the Baha'i faith are abnormal. I said, would you like to tell me? And he said, is it true that, and this is the kind of things he was taught, like in your meetings, you play a kind of blind man's buff game. I said, what's that? Like someone has to put on a blindfold and they walk around, they touch someone on the back. And whoever that is, even if it's your mum, you have to have sex with them there and then. I said, what are you? Yeah, what is
that
this?
That sounds totally believable.
I said, that is, where did you hear that? Because that's what I was taught at school. I said, you were taught that at school? He goes, this is after they dropped me, because this is why we dropped you from the team. We don't want to be infected by you. And I said, how? He goes, spiritually, we'd be infected by you. We'd probably not get our degrees. We actually made a decision. He's going to jinx it, so let's keep him out of the team. And years later, one of them came to my stand-up shows and I brought him up on stage and I said, is there something you'd like to tell me? And he said, yes, I do. And I said, I have to explain, we're in a team, I'm a Baha'i, they're Muslims, they dropped me from the team and I never got to play the final. I'm sure he wants to. He goes, yeah, we dropped you. It wasn't because you were a Baha'i, it's because you're crap. And he got the biggest laugh I've ever had.
I'm not surprised.
And I was actually very upset by it because I had no comeback to it. I said, sit down, shut up and sit down. I didn't really deal with it comedically.
So is that because I've thought of you as a fan, as someone who's able to move, just pick up these identities. I mean, I know lots of comedians try, but you're, I think, unique in your ability to just pick up these identities and then just put them down again. Is that a product of that life, of that journey?
Yes, absolutely. Because you have to understand, at a very important part of my life, you know, in the Baha'i faith, we talk about this 12 to 15 is a very important, it's a kind of the age a lot of people dismiss kids, but actually where I come from and the faith I was raised with, this is the most, you're a sponge, and this is really where you form the basis of what your future life is going to be. And for me, between 12 and 15, we had the Islamic Revolution was going on television between 78 and kind of 80, 81. And I took on different identities with different people at parties. I just said, my name's Chico, I'm from Italy. I just pretended I was something else. So I would speak with a slight Italian accent. I'd had this, I had to create a whole character for myself. Because, yeah, we're from Sicily, and my family came over. They opened up a pizza.
Is that because you were?
I didn't want to be Iranian. I was hiding. Yeah. I didn't want to be. And it's not just me. There were a few other. I had a friend of mine called Kishan Manocha, who was an Indian Baha'i, and he became, I think, Patrick something. He was like, he had a very English name, and he was like a Tory support member of the Tory party. And he became. We used to create personas for ourselves in parties where people at school wouldn't see us. So he was Patrick, the member of the Tory party. I was Chico from Sicily. And it was a role I played on Saturday nights when I'd go out at parties. And people said, oh, do you have to change your name? And I said, shut up, don't. This is who I am now, okay? For the next couple of hours, don't blow my cover. So I think that's probably where I picked up acting skills. And so I think it was a survival thing. It was a survival because the impact of a young boy, 13, 14, where his people are on television smacking their heads and looking like Islamic fundamentalists. This is not, it's not attractive for girls at the time who just thought, oh my God, are you Iranian? I said, no, I'm Italian. But it was like the worst thing. So I never had a girlfriend. I was ostracized. I remember really clearly in a Latin class, these girls were passing bits of paper. Like, who do you fancy? They're all bored. And I could see it. And one of them said, yeah. And someone put, I like Omid. And my name was there. Literally my heart was racing. And it wasn't the prettiest girl, but someone said, ugh, are you mad? These are awful. And then she went, yeah, give it back. And she put across, she crossed it out. I was cancelled straight. One ugly girl thought I was attractive, and then I was cancelled.
So you spent your teenage years pretending you were other things, and now you're spending your days pretending that you're visiting your troubadour minstrel grandfather.
I am, yes.
You're now acting yourself.
I'm acting myself, I'm acting him, and I'm doing 19 characters in this show. It's 19, and it's not so much even, I don't think I fully pull it off. It was 19 characters, and I think it might be a record. I don't know, I'm not sure, I've got to find out. But 19 specific characters, I mean, there are a few characters that come in just for like 2-3 seconds, but I've still got to make them quite distinct. I'm just trying to capture a period of time in 1 hour with 19 characters.
Having hidden your past, you're now broadcasting it in the most unimaginably public way. In terms of representation, and we joked about Gladiator when you were forced to play a kind of cliched North African slave dealer. I mean, have you experienced that in your career? I mean, have you been pigeonholed by your background?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, I used to joke about it. And when I did there was a James Bond film called The World Is Not Enough. And I was joking around on set. They goes, are you sure you're being pigeonholed again? And I said, excuse me, I'm known as an Arab scumbag specialist, but in this film, I'm playing the second Azerbaijani oil pipe attendant. That's a major departure.
Amazing.
For me in my career.
Central Asian.
And people thought I was mad. I said, this is huge. But actually, it was the same accent, doing exactly the same thing. So I think there was one film where I played Picasso. Actually, I was very happy because I was 36 and I was playing Picasso, age 36. It was a film about the Italian painter Modigliani, and it was his relationship with Picasso. It was a film with Andy Garcia. It wasn't released in Britain. It did very well in America and in Europe. For some reason, it was never released in England, in Britain. And that was interesting. That was the first time somebody just trusted that I could play a different character. And I said, why have you chosen me? Because your eyes are Picasso. And I looked at Picasso's eyes, and actually just the eye sockets are pretty similar. But I remember thinking that they said, you've got to lose weight and you have to shave off your hair. I got some hair on my back. And I remember I did it and I hadn't fully lost the weight and I was painting with my top off and they said, tell him to put your shirt back on. Like, this is not Picasso and it's really awful. So just put your shirt back on. So I didn't fully capture the essence of Picasso, but it was nice that they trusted me with that role.
Well, I hope everyone trusts you enough to come and watch you. And how do people come watch the show?
I'll be at the Edinburgh Festival at the Pleasance at 3:50 p.m. It's exactly 1 hour because I know. Actually, I'm trying to make it. I've got to shave 2 minutes off it because it's an hour, but I want to make it 58 because people want to go to another show. But it'll be there, and I really hope that I've set myself a very difficult thing to do. I'm trying to get the most serious thing ever said in a play, done in the most entertaining way. So there's bongos, there's dancing, there is poetry, and there's a lot of insanity there. And I think there's some laughs in it as well.
And lots of 19th century judicial murder. So fantastic.
Well, also you have to, not just that, but you have to suspend your imagination because I'm playing a few English society ladies, which is as a bald Iranian man with a beard. It does require a bit of imagination.
Amazing. Well, I hope everyone goes and watches that. But thank you very much.
I feel we have the history upon our shoulders.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.